Welcome to Registry Matters. This is an independent production. Our opinions are our own. We are thankful for the support of our patrons. You make what we do here possible. So, sit back and enjoy the conversation. And always remember, FYP.
Recording live from FYP Studios East and West, transmitted across the internet, this is episode 376 of Registry Matters. Good evening, Larry. How are you?
I am nice and toasty this evening.
Oh, it's probably, is it murder hot yet? It's the middle of May, huh?
It's not, but we have a continuing problem with the ventilation in our section of the building, and it's not fully functioning today, so it's a little bit toasty.
Isn't that, you have that every year, don't you?
Yes, it's been a continuing problem since they replaced the system.
Shouldn't that have solved the problems?
You would think so, but they're dealing with shysters.
Of course. Well, be sure to head over and do the likes and the thumbs up and the subscribes and all those things over on, on YouTube or in your podcast app, all that stuff. Hey, so what are we doing tonight on this episode?
I don't know. I've been thinking about it all afternoon, and I haven't come up with anything.
All right. Well, then we're just going to kick it?
No, we have a decision from the Nevada Supreme Court. And the issue in that case is where a PFR must complete their term of registration prior to becoming eligible for termination of lifetime supervision. Also, I'm working on an interesting case here in New Mexico with a PFR. He should be off the registry, but they're keeping him on. And also, you have a submission from a listener. And also, we had a last-minute comment and question coming from one of our patrons. So we've got enough to keep us going for hours and hours.
Well, fabulous. And I don't have you posted this in here just at the last minute. I didn't get a screen for it. All right. Well, hey there, Andy and Larry. Carl here in Missouri. Here's a thought that might be worth mentioning on one of your podcasts. I was recently reminded of the Missouri Halloween sign case and the win against compelled speech. It got me thinking about a related issue I'm personally dealing with. This involves international Megan's Law and the 21-day travel notice requirement. I understand that the federal notice itself may be framed as agency-to-agency communication, U.S. authorities notifying a foreign government, which might limit direct constitutional challenges. However, in Missouri, I'm required to personally complete and submit a travel notification form through the Missouri State Highway Patrol before I can travel overseas. Filling out this form is where my concern comes in. On my first trip overseas to see my wife and children, I traveled with a letter from the Sheriff's Department and had no issues. On a later trip, after being required to complete this form, I was denied entry into my wife's country, permanently banned for life, then sent back to the U.S. Because of that experience, I now know that submitting this form directly results in notification through Angel Watch to the destination country and effectively prevents me from seeing my family. So, my question is whether the requirement to fill out this form could be viewed as compelled speech. I'm being required, under threat of federal penalties, to provide information that I know will be used to restrict my ability to travel and maintain familial relationships. If I don't submit the form, I risk prosecution for failure to notify the federal government. If I do submit it, I trigger consequences that have already resulted in a lifetime ban from my wife and children's country. In other words, it feels like I'm being forced to participate in the very process that deprives me of my ability to travel and maintain family unity. Is there any potential argument here, similar to the Missouri Halloween sign case, that specifically filling out this form is unconstitutional compelled speech rather than simply a regulatory reporting requirement? That's cool. That's a neat question.
That is. That's why I threw it in there at the last moment. And the answer is that since it is apparently required by Missouri statute, he really has no choice but to submit the form. Because I'm just about certain they've had him initial that he understands that requirement when he registers. And it's a part of their statutory scheme. So he's risking state prosecution and potentially federal prosecution But his question is really more nuanced. He wants to know if his being compelled to speak that way is unconstitutional. That's the way I interpret the question. Is that your interpretation?
I think that's fair, yeah. I mean, they're telling him to fill it out, and then they're using it against him, obviously. And then if he doesn't fill it out, then he's going to end up in shackles and in prison.
All righty. But see, there's an attorney that tends to overplay the card of compelled speech. We can, as a government, compel people to speak. There's no prohibition that a person can never be compelled to speak. We compel you to speak every time you operate your vehicle with your driver's license if you have visual corrective lenses necessary. You must do that speaking. If you don't speak to the officer with that driver, if you were to deface that, I mean, normally you take the driver's license test and you have to have your glasses on. They ask if you require corrective lenses. You've been through that, right?
Oh, yeah.
Well, we're compelling you to speak because it's a public safety issue. You should not be operating a vehicle without...
And my kid's driver's license is vertical,
yes,
I guess.
Yes,
and he's under 21.
We compel minors to speak that way. We used to compel people to speak when they were carrying an infectious disease, when they were being quarantined. We compel them to speak. But he would argue, and I don't know whether this would be a solid constitutional argument, he would make the argument that his constitutional rights, A, he has a right to travel. Yes, he does. But then he would turn around and argue that they didn't admit him based on this compelled speech. Well, you don't have the right to be admitted. And that's where all their arguments break down, on the right to be admitted. So the question in my mind would be, is this compelled speech narrowly tailored enough that it would pass constitutional muster if a serious challenge were to be undertaken? Because compelled speech in and of itself is not unconstitutional. But since they apparently apply it to everyone on the registry, there's been no narrow tailoring whatsoever. So if I were him and I had a really large bank account, I would go talk to a lawyer.
How big?
A very big one. I'm talking six figures to put into this. I would go talk to a civil rights law firm and say, I want to mount a constitutional challenge on the failure to narrowly tailor compelled speech. And I think you would get more traction if you don't pretend like all speeches, compelled speech, is unconstitutional, because it is not. It's just like the people who insist all civil commitment is unconstitutional. It is not. But if you take that tack, there might be some leverage that could be gained here that would force the legislature to more narrowly tailor this requirement. And then the next question would be, if they were narrowly tailored, would you still be included? You have to ask yourself, would you fit within the contours of protecting minors? Is your offense pattern profile against a minor? How long ago was it? If you offended against a minor 3 years ago, 5 years ago, you're going to be deemed, in whatever scheme they come up that's more narrowly tailored, you're going to be deemed probably more risky than someone who has a 25, 30-year-old conviction, and it wasn't against a minor to begin with.
Isn't that part of what the 21-day notice is about, that the crime involves someone, a minor?
Well, those who the federal law mandatorily sweeps in, that doesn't stop the states from reporting everyone's.
Okay, I gotcha.
And I'm guessing Missouri requires every PFR to do that. They don't do any narrow tailoring, and that's where the challenge would ensue. You would say,
I gotcha.
That they're not narrowly tailoring this to a select group of PFRs.
I understand what you're saying. So the 20,000, whatever that number is in Missouri, the 20,000 PFRs, if any one of them decided to step foot out of the country, every one of them has to fill out the paperwork?
That's my guess. And we didn't have enough pre-show prep with this because this came in last minute. I threw it in without any research. But I'm assuming that since legislators are so hesitant to narrowly tailor because they're afraid they're going to be perceived as weak on PFRs and pro-PFR, I doubt there's any narrow tailoring in it. And that's where your constitutional challenges need to be zeroed in on, is the failure to narrowly tailor. You can do almost anything if you narrowly tailor it and based on sound reasons. And I don't think anyone can credibly argue that trying to protect citizens of foreign nations from PFRs is something, there's nothing wrong with that. But then we need a narrow framework that actually the people who pose such a risk, who might pose such an elevated risk, that they would be forced to do this disclosure, and not anyone who's just simply required to register.
Interesting. Well, Carl, sorry to... I guess it's not completely flushing, right?
No.
I mean, you gave him an avenue.
Yes, but see, what most people are hoping for, and I don't know, I can't speak for Carl, but most people are hoping that there's some organization that will just swoop in that has gobs of money and that they will fund this. That organization is largely going to be you. And when you are willing to put your money on the table, like what happened in the West Virginia challenges, we had somebody who was willing to cough up their money. I'm not big on the challenges, but a person believed in it well enough that they put thousands of their own dollars into the challenge. When you do that,
and put their name on it too, right?
That's correct. When you do that, you will find yourself being a lot more warmly received by the legal profession when you, other than you go with your tin cup in your hand and say, "Help me, I'm being abused."
Right. That makes sense too. Anything else?
I think that covers it as best I can on short notice.
Interesting. Very cool, though. All right. Well, then let's move over to this one. It's a letter from a patron in Florida. And I don't know if he's a patron. He was a patron, and then he went on a little handful of year vacation. This is from Ryan. He says, I'm trying to figure out where I can go. A friend of mine said Washington State has housing for homeless SOs, but he was able to get a job portering cars and even said he didn't have to register vehicles. I don't know how that works, since I always assumed it was a national law. But apparently every state is different. The reason I'm even thinking about this is because I can only make about $500 a month. I can't afford to move to another state, and I'm stuck in Florida. If I take my savings and go, I have a chance to get on my feet somewhere else. But if I fail in the process, I don't want to end up in prison because I'm homeless. That's the fear. Living is a tolerance. I've looked at New York. I'm assuming I'd be classified as a level one. Vermont looks promising too, though it's tiny and probably doesn't have many jobs. Maybe a good place to retire eventually. New York City scares me, on the affordability side. I'll probably have to live in some bad spots when I first arrive anywhere, just because of finances, and that opens up another worry. Oh, a chomo lives down the road. Time to kill him. Here in Tallahassee, the job market is brutal. I live in a right-to-work state, and it ain't easy getting jobs here. McDonald's won't hire PFRs. There are no full-time unskilled jobs, and I'm competing against college students for the part-time ones. I've been working on IT, but there aren't jobs here unless I go through state contracts, and it's very unlikely they'd let me compete for one. I've applied to around 700 jobs in the past 2 years and gotten about 5 interviews. None of them have hired me. I did manage one job, though, through a friend, part-time, and it was nice until I got a VOP, and the guy said he wouldn't hire me back. Right now, the market is even worse because college is out of session and most places are closed. I just filled out paperwork for day labor. I need to show up at 6 a.m. Monday if the place I'm living will even let me leave that early. Hopefully, I can pull in a few $100 next week, but I honestly don't know if I can handle the work.
That's brutal.
It is.
That is totally brutal. If a person's trying to make it in the United States, I don't care how low the cost of living is. If you're bringing in $500 a month, that's impossible. You have to be living in a mother-in-law's basement somewhere and paying nothing. That would be your survival money to pay for transportation and food.
Yep.
So that's brutal. But on the first part where he says that they don't have to register vehicles, and he assumed it was a national law, but every state is different. He's correct about that. The federal recommendations in terms of a substantial compliant registry are only recommendations. That's all they are. They have no binding. They're not binding in any way on the states. In fact, any state wants to disband their registry tomorrow, they could do that. So everything that he's complaining about related to registration is all state driven. Now, being that you said he's in Florida, you would agree with me that that's a pretty tough state for registrants, right?
Yeah, I mean, they all seem to be driving to be the worstest there between Florida, Mississippi, Louisiana, Alabama, Texas. Like, they all kind of like are in the running for the worst. But Florida seems to consistently win.
So, but yeah, I would, he's on the right pathway with trying to look around. I'm a little troubled by something I said about housing for homeless SOs. I'm curious to know more about that because I haven't been to Seattle and to Portland and those places for about 10 years, I think 2016, 2017, some last time there. But they had massive homelessness there, and it hasn't gotten much better, I don't think. So if you're thinking it's a liberal panacea, that they've got all the answers, I think you need to reconsider that because some of these liberal places that portray themselves as being the panacea and the mecca of good things, they're not. They're just not. So I'd be delighted. Have you heard anything about a particular specialized housing for homeless SOs in Washington?
No, the only thing that I think he might be conflating is that where in probably Florida, it is just outright banned. However, in maybe Washington State and those guys up there, that maybe at least it isn't just flat out banned. They might not have anything available, but you're not just said no at the door. That's just my guess.
So, and then in terms of applying for 700 jobs, now this is almost a true story. It's got a little bit of spin on it, but I've been in that position where I was virtually homeless. And due to my phone proclivities, the telephone company, as remember back in the day when we only had one source for phones.
I do.
Well, they blacklisted me because of my misuse of the phone. So
I didn't know that one.
they would not provide me service. Remember the Bell system was all unified at one time.
Yes.
So whether Southern Bell or Mountain Bell or Pacific Telesis or whatever they call it, Michigan Bell, they were all tied together, and I was blacklisted. So it got to the point that I had to leave payphone numbers.
Yep.
And sit by the payphone. You had to find one that was not near the Dan Ryan Expressway, that was relatively somewhat secluded, and you had to hope somebody would call. And so my reason for telling that story is I want to know, do you actually answer your phone? Or do you tremble in terror when you see an unknown number? Because as an employer, when I call a person, I actually don't want you to come see me. I want to talk to you first. I want to weed you out by talking to you. I want to find out if you can communicate effectively, if you can answer questions that you are not prepared for, and if you have a pleasant attitude and demeanor. And I can do that in 5 or 10 minutes on the phone. And if you make me work at getting a hold of you, I'm not interested. Now, I've had to alter that a little bit in recent years because post-pandemic, you can't find a soul. When you run ads, you can't find anybody. So I've had to moderate my rigid view about hiring people. But I never want to interview you in person until I've talked to you on the phone. And I can't believe that everybody is willing to waste time and schedule an interview for someone who's totally inappropriate for the job. So I would say if you're not answering your phone, I would encourage you to start doing that. If it's a number you don't want to talk to and you don't like what you hear, there's a little red circular button at the bottom of it. Press it and the call will go away.
Mine doesn't have that red button, Larry.
It doesn't?
No.
And another thing I can tell you to help you, when you answer your phone, if you don't recognize the number, do not say hello, whatever you do. Most calls that are undesirable are driven by interactive AI, and the AI is looking for hello. And if you say hello, it will immediately start the script. And if you say something other than hello, like any human on the line is what I say, it'll sometimes start anyway because it detects the call is engaged. But you don't have to say hello and give it an immediate invite to start talking and reading its script and going through the junk it goes through. Another thing I do if I got an unwanted call is I just press numerous buttons. And sometimes I hit a right button that transfers it to a live person, which I don't want. But I press the button because the way their systems work, it's analyzing, it's rating your phone for how well it's answered and what it gets. So I want that computer, if it's smart enough, to realize it's getting nothing but what sounds like background noise. And I want it to rate my phone as being an undesirable contact number. But I answer every time my phone rings. I pick it up every time if I can possibly do it. And I think if you try that, you might find you're getting more calls than what you think you are about your job applications.
Do you have any thoughts about the 700 jobs in the past 2 years?
That seems a lot of luck. I mean, can you imagine how many, since there's 52 weeks in a year, right?
The last time I checked, yes.
So you're applying for almost a job daily, aren't you? At 365, I mean, that's an awful lot of applications.
I'm thinking that those are through job boards, like Indeed type things, and you're almost like mass submitting. I mean, you could probably submit, I don't know, 10 jobs a minute through that if you just like queued them up and just clicked apply.
Well, I will certainly be the first to acknowledge that how people look for work has changed dramatically and how employers screen. I'm not even in the workforce at the level I can know how major operations are being done, but it's changed dramatically. But one thing that has not changed is they want an employee that's dependable and has good work ethic and has good communication skills, and it's not a slacker. And when you go in and you've been on the workforce for a long time, that presents a problem. It sounds like he's been disconnected from the workforce for a long time. And I truly don't know how you overcome that in this day and age. You can't keep saying that I was caring for a sick relative.
Yes. I want to bring up two things. One, on that thing, he's a self-taught computer programmer. That's the one thing about that, which on the one hand, is that you're self-taught, you don't have college debt and all that stuff, but then you also don't have a lot that you could put down, quote-unquote, on paper that says you have the experience or the training to do the job. And maybe that gets him flushed down the toilet. Maybe. I don't know.
Well, that's all above my pay grade on what he knows how to do on IT, because I'm probably about one step above the bottom on understanding that profession.
So the other thing is, I want to bring up, and I'm not trying to bag on the guy, but he said he's got a VOP, which I believe is a violation of probation.
That's what I interpreted.
Wouldn't that put a pretty big black eye on someone trying to apply for jobs?
Well, it suggests he's under active supervision, and that would be definitely to some detriment if you're still under supervision.
Very good.
Are you a first-time listener of Registry Matters? Well, then make us a part of your daily routine and subscribe today. Just search for Registry Matters through your favorite podcast app, hit the subscribe button, and you're off to the races. You can now enjoy hours of sarcasm and snark from Andy and Larry on a weekly basis. Oh, and there's some excellent information thrown in there, too. Subscribing also encourages others of you people to get on the bandwagon and become regular Registry Matters listeners. So what are you waiting for? Subscribe to Registry Matters right now. Help us keep fighting and continue to say FYP.
All right, then we shall continue moving along to this thing from the Nevada Supreme Court. And this is an interesting case from, as I said, the Nevada Supreme Court. The name of the case is Del Toro versus State. And I read it today, Larry. I read it while I was underneath the car changing the oil. And it's bizarre for sure. Do you want to set it up?
No, wait. You said you were doing what when you read it?
I was underneath the car changing the oil. It's that time the little dingy dingy goes off in the car and it's time to change the oil. So while I was under there, I was reading it.
All righty then. So I got to see a picture of that next time.
So I'll work on that.
The Nevada Supreme Court, and it's Nevada for some of you people, addressed a recurring statutory interpretation question. The question involves the intersection of lifetime supervision for PFRs and PFR offender registration. And John Edward Del Toro appealed an order of the 8th Judicial District Court, which is Clark County, denying his petition for release from lifetime supervision.
Well, then, so Del Toro was convicted in 2012 of attempted lewdness with a minor under the age of 14. He was classified as a Tier 2 PFR, which requires him to register for 25 years under Nevada law. After being discharged from probation in 2016, he was placed under lifetime supervision as required for certain PFR-type offenses. 12 years after his conviction, He petitioned for release from lifetime supervision, claiming he had satisfied statutory requirements. He had complied with registration obligations, had not been convicted of a subsequent offense for more than 10 years, and was assessed as a low risk to reoffend. Now, what is lifetime supervision in Nevada?
Separate from the registration requirement itself, Nevada law requires a special sentence of lifetime supervision for, I don't think it's all, but for certain PFRs. Such supervision involves daily monitoring of their lives, including their whereabouts, that means GPS, interactions, and recreational activities to ensure they conform their behavior to the individualized conditions and activity restraints. Lifetime supervision is distinct from and begins after any term of imprisonment, period of release on parole, or period of probation. So you got to understand this. You get out of prison, you do your probation or parole, and then you go on lifetime supervision. The purpose of lifetime supervision is to, quote, help law enforcement solve crimes and oversee dangerous sexual predators, as well as to prevent offenders from engaging in activities that endanger the public.
So you're saying it's a totally separate requirement in addition to all other punishment and registration?
Yes, that's what I'm saying.
All right, well, then what are the requirements to be terminated from lifetime supervision besides death?
Well, as a matter of law, offenders are entitled to release from lifetime supervision if, at the time of petition, they have satisfied three requirements. First, the offender must have complied with the requirements of the provisions of the registration statute. Now, remember what I just said, complied with the provisions of the registration statute, because that turns very critical.
I think it said it did.
Second, the offender must not have been convicted of an offense that poses a threat to the safety or well-being of others for an interval of at least 10 consecutive years after the person's last conviction or release from incarceration, whichever occurs later. And third, the offender must be deemed not likely to pose a threat to the safety of others as determined by a licensed clinical professional who has received training in the treatment of PFRs if released from lifetime supervision. They cannot pose any threat to others. So that is a pretty high standard.
All right. Well, then what did the court do in response to the petition?
Well, the 8th Judicial District Court, which is in Clark County, reviewed the petition. The state opposed the release from registration. They argued that compliance with registration requirements of Nevada Revised Statute 176.0931, subsection 3, requires completion of the full 25-year registration period for Tier 2 offenders. The district court accepted this interpretation and denied the petition solely on that basis, that the appellant had not completed his entire registration term.
And of course, Del Toro appealed?
He did.
So, wait, you just stated a moment ago that NRS 176.0931 requires district courts to release PFRs from lifetime supervision if they satisfy three requirements. One requirement is compliance with statutory registration provisions. It seems logical to me that they be released released from lifetime supervision. Why would they not be able to have their registration requirements terminated? After all, it's a civil regulatory requirement, isn't it? It's not punishment. If their supervision requirement can be terminated, why not the civil regulatory requirement?
Well, yeah, you've kind of zeroed in on what the question is for the court. It's a good question. In this appeal, the Nevada Supreme Court considered whether PFRs must register for their full registration period under that section before the other section required registration is deemed satisfied and the offender becomes eligible for release from lifetime supervision. So you've got these two competing masters. One is the registry, and the state is saying, well, we'd be happy to talk about getting him off lifetime supervision, but he's got to get off registration first. I mean, you should be able to admit that that's funny.
No, I'm not going to admit that's funny. That's definitely a quagmire. Honestly, the state's read here is kind of delulu. What's the standard of review in this kind of case?
Did you say delulu?
I did. Aren't you hip on these new terms the kids are using these days?
Delulu, I'm not familiar with that. Is that kind of like Delilah that has the radio show?
No, this is delusional.
Oh, okay. All right. So the standard review is the question. Since it's statutory interpretation, the Nevada Supreme Court reviewed the district court's interpretation of the relevant statutes de novo, meaning a brand new review with no deference to what the district court had decided.
Del Toro argued that he has complied with registration requirements for purposes of NRS 176.0931 because he has been continuously registered since his conviction through petitioning for release from lifetime supervision. Moreover, Del Toro argued because NRS 176.0931 provides that registration obligations persist even after release from lifetime supervision, completion of the entire registration term cannot be a predicate to release. That sounds pretty reasonable to me. What did the state say, of course, in response?
Well, I agree with you, but that wasn't the state's position.
Of course it wasn't. So this case turns on the meaning of, quote-unquote, complied with, and that's NRS 176.0931-3A uses, quote-unquote, complied, but does not define it. So what does, quote-unquote, complied mean?
Well, that's what the question was before the court. Now, this is why people like my senator were so important, because he was so particular about defining every word to make sure there was not a question about what complied with meant later. But the court had to do it. So the court stated, we therefore look to the dictionary definition to determine its natural meaning. Comply means to do what is required or requested, to conform, submit, or adapt to a command, demand, requirement, etc. And they cited Black's Law Dictionary, that's misspelled, I think it should be B-L-A-C-K, 12th edition, 2024. By this definition, one can comply with a requirement for a certain amount of time without completing that requirement. And that's the key to this case. He did comply with registration. He just didn't complete it.
Okay. They followed by stating, on the other hand, to do what is required may entail fulfilling the requirement. The definition does not have an intrinsic temporal element, and NRS 176.0931-3A does not provide one. Thus, looking to its plain meaning, neither confirms nor dispels the state's interpretation of comply to mean complete. Now, how did they square that circle?
Well, they stated that NRS 176.0931, subsection 4, states that a person who is released from lifetime supervision remains subject to the provisions of the registration as a PFR. Now, if that language is in the statute, and I didn't go look at it, but the court, I'm sure, did, this language indicates that Del Toro's interpretation is the intended one, because otherwise there would never be a provision for a person in that position. They would never have needed to think of that. If an offender were required to complete the full registration term before becoming eligible for release from lifetime supervision, the offender would no longer be subject to the registration mandate. Thus, reading complied in that section to mean completed would render that section meaningless, said the court.
The court correctly noted that the statute retains the registration requirement for a released offender necessarily means that an offender who has not yet satisfied the entire registration term is eligible for release from lifetime supervision. And this result is consistent with the policy motivations behind registration and lifetime supervision. That is, release from supervision reduces the restrictions on an offender's freedom where the offender has demonstrated rehabilitation and reintegration into society while enduring registration continues to assist law enforcement efforts and promote community safety.
Yep, they said that, and they also said, they stated, adopting the state's interpretation would read into Nevada revised statute, blah, 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 an automatic disqualification for Tier 3 offenders, because Tier 3 offenders must register for life. They would never complete the registration requirement to become eligible to be released from lifetime supervision. But the statute does not contemplate automatic disqualification for Tier 3 offenders. We will not read that such a consequence. Now, see, this is a beautiful example of textualism. The text is there. They went by the text. And if they had wanted that to be the case, they would have said so. So textualism has sometimes great outcomes.
Well, this seems like a nice win for PFRs, Larry, and I'll read the final paragraph. The court stated, thus, evaluating the statute as a whole, we conclude that the registration requirements under NRS 176.0931 subsection 3 does not mandate that an offender complete registration for the entire registration period delineated by NRS 179D.490. For purposes of meeting the release from supervision requirements, an offender need only show conformance to registration requirements through the time of petitioning. Here, the district court denied Del Toro's petition for release from lifetime supervision because he had not yet registered for 25 years as mandated by NRS 179D.490 subsection 2B. Because that is not required by NRS 176.0931, we conclude that the district court erred. We therefore reverse the district court's order denying Del Toro's petition and remand for further proceedings consistent with this opinion.
And the icing on the cake is the next paragraph. They stated, we hold that NRS 176.0931 does not require completion of the that term for an offender to be eligible for release from lifetime supervision. The statutes are not mutually exclusive. The registration obligation persists even if an offender is released from lifetime supervision. Accordingly, an offender is eligible for release from lifetime supervision under law if they have complied with the statutory registration requirements up to the time of petitioning for release. You know what'll be funny? If they change the law now. If they change the law now. Because they could. But I don't think they will, but they could.
Why don't you think that they will? They do it every other time.
But I'm saying they would vindictively change the law to exclude these people and say they would adopt the state's position. But that would mean that no one would ever get off, because if you have to complete registration to get off lifetime supervision, then the state would be funding the supervision of PFRs in perpetuity. And I don't think they'll do that. But that would be funny if they did.
And do you think they'll appeal? Well, this is the Supreme Court, so there's nothing more for them to do. They're done appealing, right?
There's nowhere for them to go. This is not a federal question, so there's nothing. This is the end of the line for them.
And does this impact other people or just this dude?
I know this is going to make it a whole lot better for a lot of people that have been told that they can't get off the registry. This is now published out in the legal community. So people who are wanting to get off lifetime supervision, you need to cite to this case. The lawyers will be gobbling up your money to say, hey, I can get you off lifetime supervision now because of this decision in Del Toro. So it's really good.
You can't just slip a $100 bill under the door of the judge's office with this case and say, release me?
No, you still have to go through the court the way I read the law.
God, you're no fun. All right, well then, let's head over to this New Mexico case. And you're working on a case to get a person off of the New Mexico registry. You're doing this pro bono, aren't you?
I am, and I told you it's a great business model.
It sounds like you got a guy that's willing to pay you gobs of money versus someone that's going to pay you no money, and you opt for the no money. This is the inverse of like the Elon Musk plan.
Well, but as I explained in the pre-show, the gobs case is going to require a lot of work and a lot of dedication and time because I want to do a quality job. This case, all I had to do is compose the letter, and we think the letter will work. And it's a one and we're done. And he's been so abused that I just can't see this continue to happen.
I'm just jerking your chain. I know you're a good dude. I'm not picking on you. I'm picking on you. I'm not trying to bag on you. So we will refer to him without using his actual name. So your letter states, this letter constitutes a formal request for the Department of Public Safety to remove John Doe, whose date of birth is 1981, from the New Mexico PFR registry and all related electronic publishing components of the registry. Pursuant to the statutory requirements of New Mexico's PFR Registration and Notification Act, also known as SORNA, the New Mexico appellate opinions interpreting those statutes, Mr. Doe is not required to register and should be immediately removed from the registry and the New Mexico DPS website. Tell us about Mr. Doe.
And Mr. Doe's sex offenses arose in March of 2002. He was charged with four counts, all 4-3 felonies, which is the lowest felony count we have. Counts 1 through 3 were criminal sexual penetration of a minor, age 13 to 18, and I don't know the age, don't need to know, but the person was under 18, and count four was one charge of criminal sexual conduct of a minor. On October 4th, 2002, Mr. Doe was sentenced to serve 18 months on each of the counts, with all counts to be served concurrently. Now, can you imagine that, 18 months for four sex crimes? Isn't that hilarious?
Yeah, and concurrent means on top of each other, not sequential. So not 18 months times four, but 18 months in total.
Yes,
right?
It served in they're all fold together as one sentence. So he had 18 months, and it's not a serious violent offense. It wasn't back then. I don't think those offenses are, but it would be 50% good time. So he would have had to do 9 months in incarceration.
Wow, only 9 months. Wow, that's funny, I think. So according to the judgment and his order of probation attached, Mr. Doe initially served 120 days of confinement at the county detention center. His confinement period ended on December 4th of 2002. His probation commenced the next day on December 5th and ended on February 4th of 2004. New Mexico has this unique aspect of the registration law that looks at when a person's sentence terminates to determine which registration scheme they fall in. This is just like Georgia, too. When did Mr. Doe's sentence terminate?
Well, pursuant to New Mexico law, his sentence and all jurisdiction in his case ended on December 5th, 2004, and that put him version 1.
All right. And so, okay, so that's version 1. Where were his registration obligations supposed to be?
Well, they would.
I'm sorry. What were they?
They would have been. He would have been required. Version one has two brackets. It has the 10-year and the 20-year, and both of them report annually. It's not on how much they like you. It depends on what. It's a statutory assignment of the offense. So it's a categorical approach. So the list for his offenses would be the 20-year. He would have registered once a year for 20 years, but based on Doe's date of conviction and the date of termination of his probation and jurisdiction. Mr. Doe, in his case, came under the jurisdiction of SORNA 1. He was not subject to the 2005 amendments to version 2. And those amendments were only applied to anyone who was in prison on probation or parole on or after July of 2005. I need to get this name out of here.
He just kind of squeaked in there. Yeah. Since you basically wrote it, what is the New Mexico registration law? How does it work?
Well, in order for a person to be required to register in New Mexico, he or she must have a conviction for a sex offense in New Mexico or an equivalent. Now, that's key. Not substantially similar, not anything else, but it's equivalent. If it's a non-jurisdiction, you know, other than New Mexico, it has to be an equivalent from another jurisdiction. Further, to determine if the registration applies to a particular individual, a determination must be made as to which version of the SORNA law that applies. And we have three main iterations. The first version applies to anyone who had completed the totality of their sentence prior to July 1, 2005. And that's where he falls because he got off prior to July 1, 2005. Not out of prison, but you've got to finish all obligations. The second version applies to anyone convicted on or after July 1, 2005 and to those that were still serving any portion of their sentence on that date. So they got swooped up. Now, just think about how funny this would have been. You were in a 10-year track on June 30th of 2005, and then they realigned some of those into the more serious track. So then on July 1, you went from 10 years once a year to lifetime four times a year.
Right. Now, I mean, that's how anything like that works. Like, there's a one-day thing that makes your life shitty versus not so shitty.
And the third version applies to anyone convicted. We went a different direction. This was actually my version here. Convicted on or after July 1, 2013. I wanted it to be for the commission date, but I couldn't get that into the language. I got pushback on that. So it was convicted after July 1, 2013. And that's the third version.
I see. Now, based on the dates that you just talked about, the only potentially relevant SORNA offense conviction of Mr. Doe was his conviction in 2002. The date of that offense was March 8th, 2002, and Mr. Doe completed all imposed obligations for that offense on February 4th of 2004. Isn't he being harmed?
Yes, he is very much being harmed. They have unlawfully imposed SORNA 2 on Mr. Doe. And to remedy these issues, we requested that within 15 days of receiving the letter, that the DPS issue a determination that Mr. Doe is not required to register pursuant to New Mexico SORNA law. In the interim, we also request that the DPS immediately suspend the public dissemination of Mr. Doe's personal information through the department's PFR website.
So what are the key differences between SORNA 1 and SORNA 2?
The big difference is the duration and the quarterly reporting. SORNA 2 requires registration every 90 days for life. SORNA 1, which would only require for once a year for 20 years or once a year for 10 years. It was 20 years for Doe. And there's some additional disclosures required, though subject to SORNA 2, such as internet identifiers that are not required in SORNA 1. And the funniest thing about the entire affair with Mr. Doe is that they prosecuted him for failure to comply with a 90-day reporting requirement that does not even apply to him. And I know you'll say it's not funny, but it will be funny if we can obtain compensation for their misconduct.
Like $5 compensation? Or are we talking like good cash compensation?
Well, I'm not going to be on the train other than an advisor, but if we can get him off of the registry, I would love to see him compensated because they've been, this particular county, which is in the more conservative part of the state, they have been horrendously mean to him, and they've imposed stuff on him that doesn't exist in law. And they've threatened him over and over again that they're going to turn him over to the feds for prosecution. And I told him to thumb his nose at that. I said, if you don't travel outside the state, the feds can never prosecute you. I said, if you travel outside the state, but they have just basically, I don't know how to describe it other than shitty.
Well, do you think they know that they're in the wrong and they don't have a way out, so they're being continually shitty? That would be the legal term, I suppose. Do you think that they're doing that because they know they're in the wrong?
I always hate to say that about anybody who wears a law enforcement badge because it's such a tough job with what they deal with. I mean, I know that they get criticized for being at Dunkin' Donuts, but it's a tough job getting in family disputes and all the things that they do. But what I wish you would do if you don't understand your job is to seek guidance. There are people out there that will help you, that will understand your job. But some of them, I think, just really enjoy imposing their will on individuals because they're in the powerful position that they're in. They have Correct. The badge and the gun, and you'll do as I tell you. And if we could figure out how to screen those people out in some type of psychological assessment, my job is to merely enforce the law. My job is not to make the law. And sometimes they, as you know, there was a sheriff in Butts County, Georgia, that enjoyed making the law until he was shut down.
That's correct. Well, a guy in Spalding County, too.
Yeah, well, he didn't fight as much on being shut down. But these people, you might would like for the law to say things that it doesn't say. Maybe you think that all the benefit of the doubt, I don't think they knew any better. But if they did know better, it's not your decision to think that everybody should be under the same law. The fact is, they're not under the same law. The fact is, we have three different versions. The fact that you think that someone should be under version 3 or version 2, it's not. You don't get paid to do that thinking. You get paid to do the execution of what is required of them. So, and it's not your prerogative to impose your own will on individuals.
I wonder, there's a little bit of a detour. I wonder if that isn't a reason that we the people that wear the uniform and impose these things, they shouldn't be under a higher level of scrutiny to make sure of this, not because of extra baggage and all that, that you have guns and badges and handcuffs and can put people in inescapable containers, that you should have extra supervision against you as well.
I would agree with that, but the question is, how do we do it, and who does the supervision? Because in this case, yeah, it's a sheriff who's an independent elected official, and he or she only answers to the voters of the jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. So you would not be able to create a body that would be able to usurp the sheriff's authority unless you change the guidelines that sheriffs operate. They're pretty powerful in Georgia as well, and in New Mexico. Oh, yeah, yeah. And Georgia, they're practically the king of the county.
Yeah, I'm with you. How likely do you think it is that you guys will prevail?
I think the odds, being that the law is on our side, I think we're likely to get him off the registry. And he's already asked if I'll help him with the civil litigation. I told him only in referral and consultation because this is not what I do. But I sure hope he gets some compensation for what they've put him through.
And if he does, if you guys do win, won't they be extra pissed off?
there will be, but if they have to release him from the registry, unless he's stupid enough to go out and get commit a crime, what else are they going to do? They have to let him go.
I don't know. They pull you over and they start bashing your taillights and say, oh, your taillight's out. I mean, I don't know. I'm just thinking of what you see in movies and gangster stuff.
Well, I suppose that's possible, but I'm hoping if he gets off the registry, he could get out of that county because it's not a place I'd want to live.
I totally understand. Well, I hope you guys win. And what kind of timeline? Are we talking like the next episode? Are we talking a year from now?
I think that they're going to make a decision on this letter within 30 days. We asked 15, sweet. But I think they're going to make a decision whether they're going to terminate his registration obligation very soon because it's really crystal clear. The only thing they can come back and argue is that he didn't complete a period of parole, which would have rolled him into the 2025 key date. But that's where they don't understand the law. You only do parole in the state if you do prison time. You remember he served his time in the county jail.
I see. I got you. Yeah, because it was less than a year.
Well, that's not the barrier here. It can be greater than a year if they mandate it being served in the county facility. You don't trigger unless you get a New Mexico Corrections Department number. You don't trigger that parole requirement. So they may have misread the case. They may just have assumed in those days he would have had a 1 year of 43 felonies carried, a 1 year parole period. All 43 felonies did. And that would have rolled him into 2025 past the key date. And that's probably what they're thinking if they were legitimately thinking he has to register under sort of two because they think that he was actually on supervision on or after July 1 and he was not.
Interesting. Fascinating. That's cool. I hope you guys win. For sure, I hope you guys win.
Well, I hope for his sake that he can move forward with his life. He's not an old codger yet, and he's got some potential to make some good money, and he's grossly underemployed because of all the baggage of the registry and all of his run-ins with the court, because if you look him up on the court website, he's got like 5 cases in the last 7 years. I mean, they were just throwing cases at him.
I gotcha. Well, anything else before we head out?
No, I think we had a fun episode. I think we gave good news today for everybody.
It's a first. We should mark this as the first episode of Registry Matters where everything was well, I guess not everything, but we had two things that were positive.
That's right.
Nope. Hey, I want to welcome back a patron. You may know a guy that lives in Southeast Georgia in like the most conservative county ever, who used to be employed by FYP Education.
I've heard of it, yes.
He returned as a patron at the, what was the word? What were the checks? The $1,400 checks? What were they called?
Stimulus.
Stimulus. That's right. I was thinking it started with a D. Yes. He came in back at that level. So thank you for coming back, Joey. Appreciate that.
$1,400 monthly, right?
That's correct. Well, head over to registrymatters.co for show notes and links to go everywhere, like FYP Education to find the transcript, etc. Email us at registrymatterscast@gmail.com. You can leave a old-fashioned voicemail message at 747-227-4477. And, of course, like everyone that's listening here tonight, you can join us over on patreon.com/registrymatters. And that is so very much appreciated for those that support content creators like Larry and I do. And we put this program together and spending hours slaving over a hot stove every week to deliver this stuff to you that nobody else does. People have tried, Larry. People have tried. But here we are at episode 376.
Well, my theory is that people, when they try, they figure out it's more work than they realized.
Yeah, no doubt. It does take quite a bit of work, and people are like, oh my God, you just put this together, read this. Yeah, okay. Give that a shot. 376 episodes. I'll see you there. Larry, I hope you have a great night, a great weekend, and I'll talk to you soon.
Good night.
Good night.
You've been listening to FYP.